Leviticus chapter 20. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Again thou shalt say to the children of Israel, Whosoever he be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth any of his seed unto Moloch, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. And I, verse 3, will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people, because he hath given of his seed unto Moloch to defile my sanctuary and profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do any ways hide their eyes from the man when he giveth of his seed to Moloch and kill him not, then I will set my face against that man and against his family, and will cut him off and all that go a-whoring after him to commit whoredom with Moloch from among their people. Nothing was more abhorrent in the eyes of God than the worshiping of the Ammonite deity named Moloch. The name Moloch, or Melech in the Hebrew, is king. Moloch, or Melech, was the king deity of the Ammonites. He was the main god in their groupings of false gods. He was the one that had priority. He was the one that had preeminence. And we've talked about Moloch at length in previous studies. How he demanded the firstborn from the people. The firstborn child in each family was to be placed upon the incandescent arms of that 5-foot-high cast iron idol. And as that cast iron idol was red hot, heated till it was red hot, and the babies were placed upon the arms of Moloch, the babies would sizzle, and those that worshiped Moloch would beat the drums in the valley of Tophet, or the valley of Hinnom, Gehenna. And the valley of Tophet, the valley of drumming, the drumming took place to drown out the cries of the babies. And as we have pointed out, the reasoning behind this Moloch mentality was that Moloch promised prosperity and pleasure to any family that would offer their firstborn to him. That family would be more prosperous, and that person, that couple, would have more pleasure sexually and sensually. And we have made a parallel, haven't we, about how the same spirit of Moloch exists today in our culture, in our society, where people say, we'll let our babies burn. We'll let them burn. We'll put the saline solution in the womb of that pregnant girl, and we'll burn the baby via abortion, so that we might be more prosperous. There'll be a better time to have a family, to have a child. We can't afford it now. Or, we didn't mean to conceive this kid. We were just caught up in pleasure. And if, you know, we get caught up in pleasure, that's okay. We'll just burn the baby if another is conceived on another day. It's the same thing. The same kind of deceptive spirit is at work in our culture today, without question. And God has a special and real hatred for Moloch. He pops up this Moloch figure over and over again, and we'll come across passages where kings, including Solomon, set up whole centers of worship dedicated to Moloch. And the people of Israel were seduced by these claims of increased prosperity and intense pleasure sexually. And God says, I hate that. So much so that if any man is involved in Moloch worship, if any woman is involved in Moloch worship, that person is to be stoned. And if you close your eyes to that and don't deal with that, the person who closes their eyes is to be stoned too. God says, I will not allow apathy to set in to my community, to my people. They must deal with this mentality. Interesting. There was an article in USA Today yesterday that perhaps you looked at, maybe you read. It dealt with a new survey. And the survey pointed out and said that teenagers today, one thing that they want is less time with their parents. Here we live in a time when people are saying we need to increase family hour and family activities, family events, family time. But the teens in the survey overwhelmingly said, we want less time with mom and dad, not more. Why? I suggest to you that what has happened, even those of us that have not perhaps worshipped at the altar of Moloch and seen unborn babies aborted on the arms of Moloch because of our own desire for prosperity or our own giving in to sensual pleasures in a wrong kind of way. Even those of us that haven't gone down that path or been involved in those things, maybe we too are guilty of Moloch worship in a different way. Maybe we have seen our kids put on the back burner, so to speak, while we take on second careers or third careers to make more money. Maybe we have really fallen into this mentality. Even us who love the Lord and care about our kids, maybe sometimes we too are vulnerable with choices that we make about how we spend our time and the way we choose to live. And maybe our kids get burned up or burned out in the process. I wonder. I wonder if we need to work as many hours as we do, husbands and wives. I wonder if it's that important that we get the bigger house. I wonder if those are the real issues that are really going to matter, or have we been subtly seduced by Moloch too? Have we subtly said, well, I know our kids, you know, now they're in school or what have you, or we can put them in daycare or preschool if that's applicable to you. And you know, it'll allow us to get ahead and we can get more, but maybe the kids pay the price. I wonder if Moloch is still not whispering his seductive lies in the ears of even good people, of Christian couples. I see Ross Metter back here. Ross told me years ago something I've never forgotten. When we were just young, me and Ross, way back then, meeting over at Rouge School as a church and all of that, Ross said to me one Sunday afternoon after his study, we were talking about kids and parenting in the study. He said, you know, John, here's the thing to remember. The time that we spend with our kids when they're little is the time that they'll want to spend with us when they're teens. The time that we spend with our kids when they're little is the time that they'll want to spend with us when they're teens. The time that we spend with our kids when they're little is the time that they'll want to spend with us when they're teens. And I wonder if we're not seeing in the USA Today survey, I wonder if we're not hearing the collective cry of a generation saying to mom and dad, you didn't have time for me. I was in daycare. I had babysitters. You didn't have time for me. Why would I want to spend time with you now that I'm 17 or 18 or 19? Or whatever it might be. Well, honey, Julie or Billy or whoever, you got to understand, we were just trying to get ahead. We wanted more things for you. And perhaps if they could articulate it, they might say, we didn't want your presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S, we wanted your presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E. Isn't that right? Yeah. I say this not condemningly. I say this not as a burden to anybody. I am guilty of this as well. I'm vulnerable too. All of us are in our culture. And I think we need to stop and say, Lord, have I been listening to the Moloch lie? Are my kids burned out on me? because I offered them on the arms of prosperity, wanting to get ahead, wanting to have more. And now, like our kids are saying today, collectively, we don't want to be with you guys. Sobering. God says, I don't want kids burned out. I don't want kids sacrificed. And Moloch is the deity that demands it. And I will not allow anyone who worships Moloch to be alive. And if you turn your eyes, you must die too. Notice that God is deadly serious about this. It's a matter of life and death. Notice, too, interesting to me, that when a person was to be executed, verse 2 says to me and you, that the people of the land shall stone him with stones. If somebody is interested in King Moloch or this chief deity of prosperity and sensuality, that person who is involved is to be stoned with stones. Stoning is the way in the Levitical law that people were to be put to death. Why stoning? I was watching Larry King the other night, and on the Larry King show, Phil Donahue, the father of talk show hosts, was talking and sharing, and Larry King asked Phil Donahue if there's anything he would like to do in TV if he was to come out of retirement and enter into that arena again. And Phil Donahue said the thing that he would like to do would be to air on TV a live execution. And Larry King said, now why would you want to do that? And Donahue said, not for the sensationalism and not for ratings, but rather people have made a choice collectively in our culture to sentence others to death. They ought to see what that means. They ought to understand what they're doing. Whether rightly or wrongly, they ought to see the reality of the decision that they've made collectively. There is something to that. It's easy to say, gas them, or fry them, or hang them, or shoot them, if I don't have to see it or be a part of it. God had a better idea. He said, if you're going to execute somebody, and he gives that right, in fact, it's a responsibility that he places on a community. But in so doing, you are to be involved in the process. Who, you say? Those that bring the accusations were to be the ones that threw the stones at the person. That's the way the Levitical law worked. God wanted it to be a very sobering experience that was taken very seriously by those who were making accusations. If you knew that your testimony was going to be recorded and that you would then be part of the execution team if the person was found guilty, you would think very carefully about, am I sharing the truth? And so if you were in a capital case in the Levitical law system and the person was found guilty, then he would be taken outside of the city to a certain spot where stoning took place, and you who brought accusation, you who gave testimony, would be the ones who would throw the rock at that person. I think there's a great deal of wisdom in that. And it was seen publicly. Not only would this cause people to be very careful about the testimony they gave, and to be brokenhearted about what must happen here with this execution, but it would also be a tremendous warning to the whole culture, to the whole community, that man, there's a price to pay. There's a price to pay if you get involved in this kind of stuff, in this case, in Moloch worship, you see. So God declares, if you're involved in that, I'm deadly serious about that. I don't want kids burned up. I don't want families fried. And Moloch demands it in the name of prosperity, in the name of pleasure. And those who worship Moloch, they must die. with stones. They must be stoned to death. He goes on to say in verse 6, and the soul that turneth after such as have familiar spirits, that is demons and wizards, that is psychic hotline people, and go a-whoring after them. If you turn towards those that have demons and psychic powers, so-called, and all the rest, he says, I will set my face against that soul and cut him off from among his people. That person that involves himself or herself with those things, tarot cards, fortune-telling, astrology, whatever it might be that deals with wizards, that deals with familiar spirits. What's a familiar spirit? That you might be familiar with things that you are not familiar with. Well, tell me, am I going to get that raise? Does he love me? Should I take that trip? I want to be familiar with that. That's the idea there. So you seek out psychics or those that claim to have an ability to see into the future. God declares that if you're involved with those things, that you are to be cut off from the believing community. It's not to happen. It's a warning. So, verse 7, sanctify yourselves, therefore, and be ye holy. Over and over again, we hit that theme. Be ye holy, for I am the Lord your God. And you shall keep my statutes and do them. I am the Lord which sanctifies you. The word sanctify there is kadosh in the Hebrew. Q-A-D-A-S-H. Kadosh. And kadosh simply means to set apart. That's all the word sanctify means. So in your reading, as you're going through the word and you come across that term, sanctify or sanctification, it means simply to set apart. You need to know that. Set apart. Set apart what? Set apart to God and set apart from sin. You're taking something and you're saying, Lord, I'm going to set this apart to be dedicated to you. I'm going to set this apart from the sin that it was once in. Moloch worship or wizardry or whatever it is that God is speaking of to his people here in Leviticus that ought not to be. Now he says, sanctify yourself, set apart. This raises a theological debate that's been going on forever. And that is, can we really be set apart from sin? Can we really be sanctified? Can we truly be set apart from sin, set apart to God? And there are denominations that are based upon this proposition that you can be truly sanctified. That is, you never sin again. The founder of that particular theological viewpoint was John Wesley. And he and his brother Charles, who were the founders of Methodism or the Methodist Church, good men, godly men, great men, believed that if a person was really given over to God and lived a disciplined life before God, that he or she could achieve a state of sanctity or sanctification by which they would never sin again. And they were really determined, John and Charles Wesley, to see this understanding that Christians would set themselves apart from sin and set themselves apart to God. And they developed a method to do that, from which we get Methodism. Methods. Disciplines and structure. There's methods. It's a methodical process. And if you do the method, at a certain point, you will experience sanctification. So the Wesleys propagated that vehemently. On the other side of the coin, you have John Calvin and others who said, no way can a man be sanctified completely and totally in this life. And so these two views still are in Christianity, still in the church, even to this day presently. You can go to certain churches here in the valley, and they will push for and preach about total sanctification, where a person no longer deals with sin. The problem I have with that view is the Apostle Paul, who said to me and you, "Follow me as I follow Christ," said, "Oh, wretched man that I am. What I want to do, I don't. What I don't want to do, I do." Romans chapter 7. Towards the end of his life, he wrote to his protege Timothy and said, "This is true, that God sent his Son into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the chief." Chief sinner. And Paul said that at the end of his life, at the end of his ministry. So Paul himself did not achieve or attain this sanctification that others say can be achieved. And if Paul didn't, I look at me and I say, good luck, Johnny. I do not believe that we are going to truly be totally and perfectly sanctified until we see him. 1 John chapter 3 says to you and me, when we see him, we shall be what? Like him. We're going to be transformed. Well then, what does this mean, this idea of sanctification seen throughout the Bible? If it's not talking about total sanctity, what is it about? Listen, you need to understand. If you miss this, you're going to be confused. You're going to get mixed up. It's going to be troubling for you. There is positional sanctification and there is practical sanctification. Positionally and practically. First, positionally, you are, I am, we are sanctified. We have been set apart. Positionally, we are sanctified because we're in Christ, robed in His righteousness, our sin washed away, past sin, present sin, and future sin that we haven't even done yet has all been paid for by the blood that He shed that day when He cried on the cross, "It is finished." He meant it. He didn't say "to be continued" or "a pretty good start" or "this will do for now." He said, "It's finished. The price is paid." And so Paul, there in chapter 1 of 1 Corinthians, and a second time later on, I can't recall precisely what chapter at this moment, but twice in the book of 1 Corinthians, Paul calls the Corinthian believers those who have been sanctified. And yet, were the Corinthians really sanctified practically? Have you read 1 Corinthians lately? They were a mess. They were allowing sin, incest, and fornication, and all kinds of drunkenness, and all sorts of problems. They had a huge mess there in the congregation. Positionally, though, they were sanctified. Practically, they had problems. And we are, you see, sanctified positionally, but practically, do you know you have a problem or two? But God is working on that. It's a process. It's a process that lasts your whole life. Now, notice the tension in this verse, or in this little section 7 and 8. God declares, "Sanctify yourselves, therefore." And then he ends by saying in verse 8, "I am the Lord which sanctifies you." Do you see that? God says, "Sanctify yourself," and then God says, "I am the one who sanctifies you." Well, which is it? Lord, are we to sanctify ourselves, or are you sanctifying us? Do we work on this, Lord? This idea of setting ourselves apart from sin and setting ourselves apart to you, is it something that we do, sanctify yourselves, or is it something which you do for us? As you say in the last phrase in verse 8, "I am the Lord which sanctifies you." Which is it? What do you think? What, gang? It's both. He sanctifies us, and yet He won't do it without our participation. Sanctify yourself, and I will sanctify you. You have a part to play. And as you make a move towards sanctity or sanctification, cleaning up your act, you see, then I will be there to see you through. For Jesus said, without me, ye can do what? Nothing. Without him, I can't. Without me, he won't. It's a partnership. Well, Lord, you know the problem I have with cable TV. Click, 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 click. Well, why aren't you sanctifying me? Click, 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 click. You see? God says, I will sanctify you when you choose to sanctify yourself. I'll meet you in that place. I'll meet you at that time. Rip out the cable and watch how I'll take care of the problem. It's both and. Illustrated perfectly. Remember the guy that was plagued by leprosy? His name was Naaman. His story is found in 2 Kings. Remember how he was covered with leprosy, this Syrian general named Naaman? And how he went to Israel because he heard that there was a prophet in the land of Israel who was doing miracles and wonders. So Naaman goes to Israel. And there Elisha, this prophet who was doing miracles, said to him, here's what you need to do, Naaman. Dip yourself 7 times in the Jordan River. Naaman was offended at that. That dirty river? We've got bigger, better, cleaner rivers in Syria. Why should I dip myself in that dirty little river? And one of Naaman's advisors says, Naaman, what do you have to lose? Just do it. So he did it. And after his 7th dip, suddenly his leprosy, his uncleanness, his problem was gone. He was clean, you see. But he had to do something. 7 is the number of completion or perfection. Interesting, he had to dip in water. Water in the Bible is a type of, who can recall? The Scriptures. Jesus said in John 17, as he prayed to his Father in that high priestly prayer, Jesus said, sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. May they be sanctified, Father. And your word is the means and methodology, just like Naaman. Dip in the water, Naaman, dip in the water. Get in the word. Jesus said, now you are clean through the word which I have spoken to you. Be in the word. Keep dipping. But I've dipped 6 times. We'll dip a 7th. Well, that's dippy. Then stay in your leprosy. Well, that doesn't make sense to me. Then remain in your condition that is destroying you. But if I choose, if you choose, if we choose to say, oh, we want to be free from this leprosy that's eating, that's eroding, that's defiling my marriage, my family, my joy, whatever it might be, I've got a part to play. I better dip in the word. Over and over and over and over and over. Well, how many times? 7 is the number of completion. You just keep on dipping, you see. And as I do, God meets me. And suddenly I begin to see I am being sanctified. As I am in fellowship with Him, listening to Him, and being obedient to the things that He tells me, suddenly I'm experiencing that sanctifying process. So sanctify yourselves, it's true. And the Lord says, I will sanctify you, verse 8. Interesting. Everyone, the Lord says, that curses, verse 9, his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He that hath cursed his father or his mother, his blood shall be upon him. And then in verses 10 through 21, we deal with the issue of incest and sexual purity. It's the same issues that we looked at very carefully a few weeks ago in chapter 18. So we're not going to go through each of these verses again. But God is reiterating once more that He is looking for His people to enjoy purity, that they might experience true pleasure. Stay away from the lies of the Canaanite culture with Moloch and the multi-breasted Ashtaroth and all of the rest. It's a lie. They promise you pleasure, but they're going to give you pain and problems. And the Canaanites are involved in incestual stuff, but you are not to be. Because I desire for you to be holy. Again, gang, this is the theme of Leviticus, holiness. Holiness leads to what? Come on, kids. Holiness leads to what? Happiness. You shall be holy unto me, for I, the Lord, am holy. I want you to be happy. And this is how it works. Be holy. Stay away from these things. A couple of things I do want to point out. In verse 10, it does say, notice that if a man is caught in adultery with his neighbor's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. Caught in adultery, both are to pay the price equally. Both are to die, you see. Well, what's the big idea? God is simply declaring that adultery causes death and pain. Dealing with that again today. How adultery causes death. Families split apart. Relationships die. It's tragic what takes place. And God is not being meany or prudish here. He's being prudent. He's a loving Father who says wisely, know this. Adultery kills. It just kills. By the way, this gives me insight about the John 8 story. Remember in John chapter 8, when the woman was caught in adultery, they were going to stone her, but Jesus stood up for her. Jesus cared about her because Jesus saw that it was a sham. Now, how did he see that it was a sham? It was a setup. Because where was the man? Master, they said, we caught her in the very act of adultery. Interesting. If she was caught in the act, then where's the man? It says in the law that both the man and the woman who are caught in the act are to be dealt with in the same way. They're both to pay the price that day. So those guys weren't interested in justice. They wanted to entrap Jesus. They didn't care about the law. They wanted to trip up the Lord. Well, that's a whole other story. But this makes it clear that Jesus knew from the very get-go that what they were doing that day was not sincere. Because the man should have been brought too if they were interested in really truly keeping the law of Moses. It also says in verse 13, another comment I want to make before we leave this section. If a man lie with mankind as he lies with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. Again, because we talked about some of these things a few weeks ago in chapter 18, I've received a bit of feedback concerning homosexuality and culture today and what the Bible has to say. I thought I might, and I did. The fact of the matter is this. God declares that homosexuality is an abomination. Why? Understand this. We are made in the image of God. Mankind was created in the image of God. Do you know that? You were made in the image of God. Now, God is a creator and God is a giver. God's a creator and God is a giver. We are made in His image. We too are to be creators and we too are to be givers. Create what? The miracle that God has given to you and to me is that we might create, that we might reproduce. And that is why He said, be fruitful, multiply. This is the one chance that you can be like me, God would say, in the arena of the miraculous. You have the privilege of reproducing. Homosexuality and lesbianism directly contradicts that. They don't have kids. Do you know that? At least in a natural way. God is a creator. And He says, you are made in My image. And you're to be like Me. Not just a creator, but you are to be a giver. What do you mean a giver? You know what makes you a giver more than any single other thing in life? Having kids. Do you know that? Having kids forces you and forces me to be givers. Oh, man. You can't just do what you want, when you want, go where you want. All of those things, hey, once you have a baby, once you have a kid, once you have a family, everything changes. No longer is it about you. Those kids suddenly start setting the agenda. And when that little baby wants to eat, you stop what you're doing, you know, and you feed the little guy, or you ought to. But kids totally obliterate this idea of being selfish and self-centered, self-absorbed. God knows that. Last night, you know, when the women's thing was going on. I was home and Ben and I were together and he wanted to watch this tape, this videotape thing, an hour long of the Denver Broncos highlights. I hate the Broncos. Now, if it was a 49er highlight film, that would have been heaven for me. But the Broncos, I hate the Broncos. But Ben wanted to watch it. You know, so there was this other thing on TV that I kind of wanted to pick up on, a Washington Week thing on Channel 8. Real exciting. I was really looking forward to this thing. But Ben, come on, Dad. Okay, I hate the Broncos. But that's what happens when you have kids. And we had a great time. Sort of. Listen, homosexuality is the epitome of selfishness. It's self-focused, it's self-absorbent, and it is not only being a taker, but it's preventing creation. In fact, it is selfish and destructive. You destroy. And I said this before, and I'll take the flack again. The only way homosexuality as a community to grow is via recruitment. Let that never be forgotten. Not through creation, but by recruiting, by seducing. And it's an abomination, you see. It goes against the character of God. It goes against the commandment from God. The character of God is to be a creator. He's a creator and a giver. For God so loved the world, He gave. And we too are to be creators and givers, not destroyers and takers. And that's what homosexuality is about. That sin must not be indulged in or tolerated. Period. We love them. But we must not say the sin is okay. It's not. It's not. God here is very clear about that, I believe. Finally, one more comment. You're not, verse 19, to uncover the nakedness of thy mother's sister, nor of thy father's sister, for he uncovereth his near kin, they shall bear their iniquity. Again, back to verse 17, if a man shall take his sister, his father's daughter, his mother's daughter, and see her nakedness, and she see his nakedness, it is a wicked thing. Now, obviously the primary application of this deals with incestual matters, but there's a secondary application that the rabbis address in the Talmud that needs to be, I think, thought through by me and you too. And that secondary issue, obviously incest, forbidden, can't happen, it's destructive, it's detrimental, it's brutal, regardless of what the American Psychiatric Association Journal is saying. We talked about that, didn't we, last time? A few times back. But there's another application here, and that is this. It's part of the 60s thing, where somehow in the 60s thing, it became cool to just sort of be free. And families would feel free to be naked around other family members. And if, you know, kids saw their parents naked, that was cool and free and liberating and non-Victorian. And if brothers and sisters saw each other naked, that's cool because we shouldn't be repressive or prohibitive lest there be, you know, hang-ups and all the rest, you see? I really believe that's a huge mistake, and the rabbis deal with that, as I say, in their Talmudic discussions. That if that is allowed to happen, this nakedness in the home, incest obviously prohibited, but it applies to seeing family members naked too. It ought not to happen. Now, I'm not talking about if a person's one or two, but I'm talking about where this goes on in the family, and we then say, you know, it's okay. They need to understand that we're free, that we're not hung up and all the rest, because that kind of liberty leads to looseness. That was the rabbinical interpretation, and I wholeheartedly agree. There needs to be, I think, an awareness in our kids as they're growing up, not of prudishness, but of prudence and propriety. That is, there's something wonderful, special, mysterious about sex that is to be explored and understood, celebrated in marriage. And I think that we do a disservice to our kids if in our homes we say, well, you know, Johnny's only 15, so it's okay if he's naked, or you know, Sally's only 12, or and I'm exaggerating, but you know, not by much in some cases. Some people in some homes, they have a very loose standard in this area, and I think it's a mistake, and I think Leviticus is dealing with those things too. Well, you say, at what age is that to be put away? When a person realizes they're seeing their father's nakedness, their sister's nakedness, their mother's nakedness. A kid will let you know when he suddenly sees nakedness. Are you with me on that? Kids, they'll let you know. And once a kid realizes that they're naked, just like in the Garden of Eden, who told you you were naked? God said to Adam and Eve. They knew. And so too, there comes a point when kids know. And man, I would really caution you against the 60s thing if you're from that generation, because it leads to a loose attitude towards sexuality that ought not to be, that will not be good for those kids in the long haul, in the long run. I think the same thing is true. Now I'm going out on thin ice here, I know. But I think the same thing is true when it comes to breastfeeding in public. I watch and I see good, wonderful Christian ladies, you know, breastfeeding in a way that's just kind of not discreet. That's not private. But, oh well, so what? This is a natural, beautiful thing. Yes, it's natural and there's a beauty to it, no doubt about it, but there needs to be an understanding of God's heart. God is not embarrassed by that, but he realizes the repercussions of that. And so I think a woman who is nursing her child in public should do so with great discretion. And you can do that with discretion and care. You don't have to say, oh, I'm a natural woman, you know, and all that kind of stuff. We know you are. Don't have to prove it to me, you know. I'm... You say, well, John, these things are obvious. If they weren't obvious, I wouldn't be addressing them as your pastor and as a friend. I think they're not as obvious as they ought to be in some of these cases. So God is declaring here, in family matters, obviously no incest, but don't go about in these naked states and conditions, you see. Well, verse 22, you shall therefore keep all my statutes and my judgments and do them, that the land where I bring you to dwell in spew you not out. And you shall not walk in the manners of the nation which I cast out before you. For they committed all these things, and therefore I abhorred them. But I have said unto you, you shall inherit their land. I will give it to you to possess, a land that flows with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, which have separated you from other people. And you shall, verse 26, be holy unto me. For I, the Lord, am holy and have severed you from other people that you should be mine. I've given you a new land, a fresh start, a real blessing, a land that flows with milk and honey. And those that had it before you, the land spewed them out. That's an interesting phrase that comes up over and over again in the Old Testament scriptures. Notice this. Verse 22, that the land, last phrase, where I bring you to, spew you not out. The land spewed out the Canaanites. The land spewed out those cultures where there was promiscuity and idolatry and all sorts of debauchery and depravity and homosexuality and incest and all the rest. The land spewed it out. Now God uses this phrase over and over again. God says the land spewed them out. In other words, there's built into creation certain laws that if those laws are violated, there's going to be repercussions. There's a law called gravity. If I go to the top of a 10-story building and say, well, you know, I don't know if this is an absolute principle for everybody. I'm not sure that it applies to this day. It was okay for them back then, but times have changed. We live in an enlightened age. There's greater education, greater understanding, greater tolerance. And so I jump from the 10-story building. Yeah, I'm free, I'm free, I'm free, I say for about 2.5 seconds. And then I splat. And I've got a broken back and a broken skull and a broken leg and a broken nose. And I'm bloodied and bruised and battered. It is not God punishing me. God isn't saying, ha ha, gotcha. There is a law built into creation called gravity, and if I violate that law, there will be repercussions. Absolutely. I will get banged up. I will get beat up. I will get bloodied up. And so too, culturally, God says, built into this thing called creation, when a culture chooses to get involved in perversion, that land will spew out that culture. It's interesting. The phraseology is exact. You say, well, how does that happen? What does that mean? God is simply saying, it's not simply me judging them. There's a principle built into the planet that says if a culture practices perversion, the land that they are in will spew them out. That culture will collapse. And you look at the Egyptian Empire. and you look at the Assyrian Empire, and you look at the Greek Empire, and you look at the Roman Empire, and you see common to all of those great empires was they allowed homosexuality and incest and moral perversion to creep in, and they were cast out. They were thrown down. Any culture, any nation that violates what God says, these are the rules and regulations, this is how it works, there will be natural repercussions. And God says the land itself will... But we're Americans, God. We speak English. No, we're not like those other guys back then. God would say, hey, any land, every land where these things happen, that land will spew out the inhabitants thereof. The culture will collapse. So be holy. Choose wisely, God says. That's the way it works, just like the law of gravity. It's not that I'm mad at you. It's not that I'm coming down on you necessarily. It's the natural repercussions of what you've chosen to do. Quickly, chapter 21. Rules and regulations for priestly ministry. We talked about this on Sunday. The priestly ministry. Priests are those who simply stand before the people on behalf of who? And stand before God on behalf of people. That's what a priest does. Stands before people on behalf of God. Stands before God on behalf of people. Well, who cares about that? I'm not a priest, you say. Yes, we are. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5 says to you and me that we are a what? A royal priesthood. A chosen generation, right? A royal priesthood. You and I have been called to do just that. Stand before people that we work with, that we live by, that we hang around. To stand before people on behalf of God. And then to stand before God on behalf of people. We have been saved to serve. He's left us here for a reason. He didn't rapture you when you asked Jesus into your heart. Because you've been left behind to be involved in priestly ministry. And so he speaks about the priestly ministry with application to you and me, because we are not sons of Aaron, we are sons of God. Sons of Aaron were priests in the old economy. Sons and daughters of God, you and me, are to be priests in this New Testament dispensation, you see. Speak unto the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, there shall none be defiled for the dead among his brethren or among his people, but for his kin that is near to him, that is for his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, or his sister, a virgin that is nigh to him, which hath no husband, for her he may be defiled. But, verse 4, he shall not defile himself, being a chief man among his people, to profane himself. The priests are not to hang around dead bodies, except if it be for family. Note that. You're not to defile yourself, verse 1, for the dead. Don't hang around dead people. Well, you say, I don't plan to. Well, we're not talking about physically in our economy. Remember, the Old Testament is physical and material. The New Testament is spiritual and eternal. And we don't hang around dead corpses, obviously. But do you, do I, do we hang around people that are dead spiritually? Hang out with them. We're not to do that. Don't hang out with the dead. Unless the reason is family. What do you mean? To bring them into the family. To bring them back from the dead. If the purpose for your hanging out with the dead is because you say, hey, I want to share my faith with him. I'm sharing my faith with them. I'm sharing my faith with her. I'm seeing that they are being brought into the family. Then you're doing what Jesus did, who was the friend of sinners, because he had a desire to see them brought into the kingdom. The priests here do not hang with the dead unless, except, it's for family reasons. I tell my kids this all the time. You don't hang with the dead unless the purpose is for you to truly be witnessing, be ministering, be sharing with them. That's a whole different matter. Yeah, you can go to that party, Mary. If when you go in there, you're preaching the gospel and praying for people, laying hands on folks that are sinning, and just going for it, yes, you can go. Is that your intention, honey? You see. Is your intention to go change that party, or is that party going to change you, Mary? Is that party going to change you, Ben? Is where you're going to change you, or are you going to change that? Now, if you're going to change them, and you can, you have my blessing. But I look them in the eye. I have this laser look that I do. You know, tell me. I'll say, are you going for the purpose of witnessing, of loving people in the name of the Lord, of sharing truth? Is that your true motivation, intention, and priority? I don't buy it, honey. You know? You see. Priests and priestesses are not to hang around the dead unless it's for the reason of family. And verse 5, they shall not make baldness upon their head. That knocks Jimmy out, I guess. I don't know, Jimmy. It's Mom's not happy with me at all. I'm getting the laser look from my mom right now. There's the laser look right there. Uh-oh, I'm in big trouble here. No, he shall not make baldness upon their head, neither shall they shave off the corner of their beard. I didn't see that one. Nor make any cuttings in their flesh. The shaving of the head, the cutting off of the beard, the cuttings in the flesh are all part of the Egyptian death cult. And if a person is bearing the marks of death, that is, you know, Grateful Dead or Black Sabbath or Mega Death or whatever it might be, it ought not to happen, period. If you're marking yourself intentionally in a way to identify with the death cults, death and darkness, and you can walk in to a room and you can sense in that room, in that child's room or adult's room for that matter, if it's been marked with death, if they're dressing like death, if there's an aura of death, and that's what's being talked about here, don't mark yourself, don't identify with, don't be one who gets involved in the deathly cults of the world. Don't go there, God is declaring. Don't do that. And verse 7, these priests shall not take a wife that is a whore, or profane, neither shall a whore or profane, neither shall they take a woman put away from her husband, that is a divorcee. For he is holy, the priest is holy to his God. Thou shalt sanctify him therefore. For he offereth the bread of thy God, he shall be holy unto thee. I, the Lord, which sanctify you, am holy. So the priests were to be careful about who they took on to marry. They were to marry a godly woman. Again, they were to realize that marriage is foundational for ministry. That the marriage that a man has or a woman has provides the credibility for ministry. And if there's whorishness or profaneness or brokenness, then that person will not have the credibility or the foundation for ministry. If it doesn't work at home, it doesn't work, you see. It needs to work. It needs to be cooking at home. I went over last night after Tammy came back from the woman's thing. We went over on the invitation of my daughter, Christy, who just got married to Seth. And they just moved into their apartment there out towards Phoenix. Just got it fixed up and we went in. They had us over for dessert and Christy was making these dessert things up. They were delicious. There were these white puffy things that had chocolate on the inside, and they were real cool. And then she had these chocolate cookie things with peanut butter mixed in. They were delicious. Just great. I ate a few. I'm so proud of those two. It was such a blessing. They just invited us to come, and this was Christy's first, you know, entertaining thing as a wife. And Seth said, yeah, it was really cute. He said, you know, she was there this afternoon just really scrambling, working, you know, and she said, Seth, come here. And Seth came, this just doesn't look right. And Seth said, well, what's in this batter? She said, well, it's the egg whites. And he says, that's the egg shell. And Christy says, well, isn't that what an egg white is? She thought the white of the egg was the shell, so she put all these shells in there. You know, five shells in this thing. The dessert was very crunchy, but it was, you know, it was... Oh, my. We cracked up. Get it? Cracked up. Things have got to be right at home. That's a stretch, I know. But things have got to be cooking right at home, you see. They've got to be right if there's going to be credibility in ministry. So you don't marry a whore, a prostitute, so to speak, or a profane woman, one that's not interested in the things of God or living for the Lord. Don't do that. It'll ruin your ministry, you see. And the daughter, verse 9, of any priest, if she profane herself by playing the whore, she profanes her father. She shall be burnt with fire. Whoa. The priest whose daughter is playing the whore is fired from ministry in the sense that he's going to see his daughter burn. This is the only time when God prescribes burning for punishment and not stoning, as we talked about before. It's always stoning except when a child is out of line. What a heartbreak. But God is declaring here that it's a real burn. It's a sad thing. There's nothing more heart-rending or heartbreaking than to see a child, particularly a daughter, who has chosen to play the whore. And that daughter is to be burned with fire. It would be a very shocking, a very devastating, a very sobering thing for the community to see this dad bring his daughter forth and see her burn with fire. It's not that God is being cruel or mean. God is saying, I want this lesson burned into the fabric of this culture that men, you're responsible to care for your daughters, to pray for them, to care about them, to give training to them. And daughters, you need to realize that you are going to burn your parents and burn ministry if you go in this way and play the whore, you see. So often people read these things and say that seems patently, grossly unfair, unkind. Realize that it doesn't mean that these people who are dealt with in those ways are in hell. It could be that that will be the most important ministry that they'll ever be allowed to do. It could be that when Achan, for example, was stoned along with his family, or when a girl is burned because she's chosen to live promiscuously or whatever it might be, it's a tragedy, it's a heartbreak, but perhaps that's the most important ministry that she or they will ever do. You got to keep in mind there's a big picture called heaven, called eternity. And God is saying, the only way I can use you, perhaps, is to make a real impression on a culture that will have a tendency to give themselves over to perversity, that will destroy, what will cause the land to spew out the whole culture. So this is the mark that you're going to leave. It's going to be a burn to your parents. It's going to be a heartbreak to your family. But at least something will be redeemed from this. If indeed she had a heart towards God. If she doesn't, then she goes from that fire to a greater one. So that is the case. And he, verse 10, that is the high priest among his brethren, upon whose head the anointing oil was poured, he shall not uncover his head, nor rend his clothes. We talked about this Sunday, didn't we? You don't rend your garments. And if you weren't here, get the tape. In times of difficulty, trial, tragedy, in times of heartbreak, heartache, whatever it might be, the priests, you and me, we ought not to rend our clothes. There's something better to do. And God declares, but rather they are to stay, verse 12, in the sanctuary, keep on serving. And watch and see how in the act of serving there will be healing and help. When you get your eyes off yourself and don't rend your clothes, that outward sign of consternation, of depression, of all the rest. And we talked about that Sunday at depth. Get the tape if you weren't here. Well, then it talks about, as we go on through this chapter, it talks about what would disqualify a man from priesthood physically. If he's blind or has a flat nose or broken footed and all the rest. And we'll look at those things in our next study because they're interesting. And we'll stop here tonight and we'll come back to chapter 21 and look at this and learn some lessons about the man that God can use and how it applies to me and you. You say, John, that we're priests and priestesses, but I don't know what my sphere of service is. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Let me remind you once more, as we've been talking about here for months of recent, the most important ministry you have is your kids and your grandkids, your family. That's your ministry. And that's why the Lord talks to these priests about that. If your marriage is a mess, you're in trouble. If your kids are going in the wrong direction, you're going to be burned. There's going to be some real problems, some pain. Make that your priority. And I know that some hearts are hurting. Some souls are aching because you would say, I have a son or a daughter who have gone astray and are playing the whore. Listen, the enemy goes after those kids that he sees has the greatest potential. Never forget that. And if your son or your daughter has been targeted by the enemy, don't despair. Oh, you need to take it to prayer. You got a lot of work to do. There's a battle before you. But know this. Jesus said to Peter, Satan wants to sift you like wheat. Why? Because Jesus knew that Peter had unbelievable potential. And Jesus said, Satan wants to sift you, but I have prayed for you that your faith fails not. And when you are converted, Peter, strengthen the brethren. You're going to come through this, Peter. You're going to feel like you've hit the bottom. You're going to feel like it's impossible. You're going to deny me. You're going to take an oath. Let me be damned, Peter said literally. He swore, he took an oath, let me be damned if I am not telling the truth. That is, I don't know him. A worse sin than any of us could possibly imagine. Taking an oath of damnation in his denying of Jesus Christ. But you see, Jesus knew that Peter had unbelievable potentiality. Mom and Dad, Grandma, Grandpa, don't give up. Those kids that have gone away, you feel burned today. You feel brokenhearted. Know this. Man, it's because they have great potential. And now here's your ministry. Pray for them. Intercede on behalf of them. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against what? Principalities and powers. That's where the battle really is. And when they are converted, they will strengthen others too. Any of you wonder what your ministry is? It's at home. Well, you say, I live at home. Good. Then honor your parents. Reverence them. Minister to that little brother that looks up to you. Or that little sister that thinks you're just cool because they don't understand what a wretch you are. Take advantage of the opportunity. Father, I pray that we might find ourselves in our land, not allowing perversity, lest there be a spewing, a rejecting, a burning. But cause us, Lord, to be those that see the ministry take place through prayer, by example, via instruction. Father, we have dropped the ball. We missed the opportunities. But we come to you tonight hearing your heart once more and want to see holiness in our homes. Help us. Lord, help us to sanctify ourselves that you might sanctify us. Cause us, Lord, to make wise investments of time and energy in our kids, in our grandkids, that, Lord, they might want to spend time and make investment back into our lives in days to come. Father, I pray that you would just now take these scriptures, bring them into practical application. In the name of Jesus, Lord, help us to be not a pharisaical, holier-than-thou kind of people, but help us to be wholesome and whole. May we be holy, Lord, that people might see a joy, a happiness, a life, and be drawn to you. Not some principle, not some crusade or cause or doctrine, but may they be drawn to you, Jesus. May they see the abundant life that you do give to those who do choose to walk with you. Father, please sanctify us. Cause us to be holy in the name of Jesus. Amen.